We have been going through this little story of Ruth. I kind of thought to myself, this has got to be overcooked by now. But it's apparently not.
We'll see today.
We'll see today. So the passage that I want to look at is from the last chapter, verse 13, chapter 4 and verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. I believe in marriage. I want to live my marriage out loud. I want to enjoy every married day I've got. I want to grab a hold of the purpose for which God gave me marriage. And I want God to be able to paint upon the canvas of this marriage the beautiful story of His gospel. Have you ever asked yourself why people get married? I think in today's culture, that's a question many young people and older are asking. There's some very, very strange reasons why people get married. Like many people, this is a quote from someone, like many people, I respond to ritual. Irrational as it may be, I wouldn't want to have a birthday party 47 days after my birthday. When I turn 50, I intend to celebrate. I know that that's arbitrary. Why 50 and not 51? For the same arbitrary reasons, I respond to the ritual of marriage. Marriage is just ritual and arbitrary. No explanation, no reason, no higher purpose. Well, how's this one? Men are like taxi cabs. When they're available, their light goes on. They wake up one day and they decide that they're ready to settle down, have babies or whatever. And they turn on their light. And the next woman they pick up, boom. And that's the one they marry. It's not fate, it's just dumb luck. Imagine believing that about marriage. You see, this book of Ruth, it's a fabulous story. And it has cliffhangers and emotional roller coasters and the reality of pain and hurt and bitterness and the joy of seeing God's kindness and the outbreaking of God's sovereign provision. And there's this beautiful story and it's love and it's, I mean, there's moments where you start sweating and biting your nails. I mean, I'm thinking of the threshing floor with Boaz and Ruth and the dark starry sky all alone. Is their hearts pounding, clearly in love. And I think, oh. But this whole story is heading towards, it's like the last chapter in the book. Don't spoil it by reading the last verse. The whole story really is heading towards, and Boaz took Ruth, and they got married, and they had a child. That's kind of where, at a natural level, this whole story is heading. Through all the bumps and roller coasters and hairpin bends, like your life and mine. And I honestly think that in today's culture, we need a biblical view of marriage. And we need a biblical understanding of why God gave us this institution. Hebrews 13 and verse 4, let marriage be held in honor among all. Let marriage be held in honor among all. That word honor is used elsewhere in the New Testament. In 2 Corinthians, Paul uses the same word when he speaks of gold and silver and precious stones. Peter uses it in chapter 1, precious blood of Jesus. Peter uses it again in 2 Peter, the precious and very great promises of God. This word honor, when we think of marriage, we should think of something to be honored, precious, above and beyond compare, something so noble, something that is God-given, something that is God-inspired, something that He put in the very garden straight after He created man and woman. He gave them to each other as husband and wife. We should live with a high view, whether single or married. We should live with this high view of this precious thing that God gave us in marriage. Jesus said in Luke 14, salt is good, but if salt loses its taste, how shall its saltiness be restored? It is of no use either for the soil or the manure pile. It's thrown away. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. We are salty, friends, to the degree that we are not in sync with this world's philosophies. To the degree that we flow with the spirit of this world and the way we think about anything, we lose our saltiness and then we're not even good for the manure pile. Ever thought about your life that way? We are salty because we take God's perspective on things. We live with God's holy vision of marriage. And that's for both single and married men and women. I honestly believe, you know, I asked Adrian the other day, I said, what percentage of your counseling time is spent on marriage? And he said, oh, probably way over 90%. Marriage in the community of believers is of crucial importance to the revelation of God here on earth. It's not some incidental bypass thing that we can ignore and treat lightly. It's to be held in honor as precious. You know, I got married at 40. And it's very slow. But you know, there's reasons I was very slow. The church I grew up in never preached marriage. Marriage was not lived out loud. Marriage was not something that was esteemed or held highly. And that rubbed off on me. You have no idea what the preached word and the lived out examples do for what you believe about God. And what you believe about God translates into the way you do your life. And the church I was in, I imbibed that thing. Marriage to me was just unimportant. And then, you know, I left that church after the pastor, his marriage dissolved. And I changed not only churches, but countries. And I went and I joined a small church where I was living in the UK. And I was so church-wise, I thought no one could teach me anything about church after all of that I had been through. And I ran into the most unbelievably potent witness of God's love in the saints that I found myself amongst. And marriage was preached. Marriage was lived out on the front row. The first friend I made in the UK, and to this day he's a close friend, invited me into his home, and he was married and he had kids. And my eyes were opened, and 6 months later I came home and put a ring on that lady's finger. Mentorship and the example of those around you, that's meant far more to me than anyone who's ever dumped a pack of notes on my table and said, here, read this. You know, when I first got married, I was completely like all of you were clueless as to how to do that. I thought I was at 40. You know, you kind of think you know something. I knew nothing. And God's grace upon me was I realized I knew nothing. I experienced the fact that I knew nothing. But in this community, they don't even know it. I looked at Stephen and Kathy. And I looked at the way they did marriage. One of Irene's biggest gripes with me was I was so petrified of women that I never held her hand before we got married, almost. I certainly never kissed her. And when we were married, she said to me, no, people don't even know that we're husband and wife. And I realized I needed help. And you know where I got my help? Was this community. I watched marriages. I watched Stephen with Kathy and that he just couldn't keep his hands off her. And it instructed me. And now I can't keep my hands off my wife. It's very cool. If I were the devil and looking for a way to somehow corrupt the image of God on earth, the revelation of God on earth, I think there are two things that I would go for first. And it's clear that those two things have been gone after by him. One would be marriage and the other would be sexuality. Because in the garden he made them male and female in his image. The image of God is inextricably and wonderfully linked and displayed in maleness and femaleness. And the image of God is on display and brought to completion when man marries woman and they live out their marriages. If somehow the devil can corrupt marriage and sexuality or confuse those issues, he has very effectively in some way silenced one of God's strongest witnesses of the gospel here on earth, which is beautiful marriage and wonderfully lived out maleness and femaleness. I often tell young men, there is nothing on earth that will assay the depth and sincerity of your masculinity than marriage. You know, sometimes I get the feeling that young men think marriage is the missing link in their being Christ-like or being truly human or being truly male. Marriage is no missing link. Marriage is the great revealer of what you really are as a man and a woman. There is nothing on earth that will strip the mask from your face and leave you completely naked in both senses when it comes to what you are as a man and a woman. The single you are is the married you will be, only more. So don't wait for marriage to in some way complete you. It's not going to. It's going to reveal you. You see, from a natural perspective, this book is about, at the end, getting married and having children. From a spiritual perspective, of course, and Stephen did such a beautiful job of this last week, showing us this redemptive picture of Boaz, who's Christ-like and brings redemption to this lost exile Moabitess woman who had no hope of anything in life. And she turns out to be this incredibly redeemed woman who gives birth to Obed, who's in the line of Jesus. It's like marriage, you see, is this canvas upon which God paints his beautiful picture of redemption. Maybe your picture needs just touching up. Maybe the colors have run. Maybe the colors have faded. Marriage without a God-given purpose is like a body without a spirit. It's like trying to explain redemption without the incarnation. Marriage incarnates something of God's redemptive purpose and love for the world. That's what Ephesians 5 is all about. You see, this is the wonderful thing about Old Testament narrative. You can't preach Old Testament like you do Romans. Romans is not a story. But the Old Testament is a story. It's like you and me. That's why we need the Old Testament. Romans tells this, I mean, Ruth tells this wonderful story, and it wraps up the redemptive love of God in the flesh and blood of a man and woman who live masculine and live feminine and get married and display the image of God on earth. G.K. Chesterton said this, and I love it. The only two things that can satisfy a soul are a person and a story. And even the story must be about a person. Don't you love that? We love stories, and those stories must be about people. And that's what Ruth is. So let's look for a moment at this woman, Ruth, and what the roots are of what, you know, Boaz looked at Ruth and called her a worthy woman. What are the roots of Ruth's worthiness? And what were the things that made Boaz this incredible picture of masculinity and husbanding? I think if we look at Ruth, and let's spend some time looking at what Ruth and what it was. When Boaz looked at Ruth, what was it that he saw that made him blurt out, worthy woman? I think if we consider, just listen to Ruth 1. Ruth says to Naomi, after Naomi's desperately tried to get her to go back to her people. You know, of course, Orpah goes back to her people. She gives up. It was all a fake. It was not real. There was no, it hadn't changed her. But Ruth says this to you, to Naomi, where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people. Your God, my God. Where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord do to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you. This Moabitess woman who'd grown up in a land and a culture that was completely against God. You know the Moabites, what they so hated the Jews and their God. You know what the Moabites used to do to offend the Jews? There were times in history where the Moabites would take a pig and slaughter it in the temple and throw its head and scatter the pig's blood over the Hebrews' holy temple. That's the kind of hatred that they had for this God of the Hebrews. And that's the culture that this Moabitess woman grows up in. Something changed. Something radically changed. She was completely and utterly converted. Her heart, she saw, and where? How? Who was the witness? It can only have been Naomi's faith. But Ruth came to a deep, real, radical, life-changing experience with God. And that, to me, has got to be one of the deepest roots of true femininity. When a woman, and you know, Ruth didn't do this to find a man. She did this because she walked into the redemptive love and grace of the God of the Hebrews. And you know, Ruth, most immigrants leave for a better life. Ruth didn't do that. She left for a harder life. She laid her life down for Naomi because she knew Naomi would die without her help. Ruth didn't go to an easier life. She went to a significantly harder life, to an almost definite life of perpetual singleness and difficulty. Her life was, what would cause a woman to do that if it wasn't a picture and a vision of God's love for her? She was completely converted. Boaz said to Ruth one night, "The Lord repay you for what you have done, and for the full reward, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Under whose wings you have come. True women take refuge under the wings of God. In verse 11 of chapter 3, he calls her a worthy woman. That's what he saw. You know, there are a couple of New Testament passages which I think display and describe this woman, Ruth, beautifully. 1 Peter 2, "You're a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people of God's own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who's called you out of darkness into his marvelous light." Listen to this. "Once you were not a people," that's Ruth, "but now you are God's people," that's Ruth. "Once you had not received mercy," that's Ruth, "but now you have received mercy." And Ruth's femininity puts on display this glorious God. That's the calling of a woman. There's this other passage which I think gets down to more nitty-gritty around what makes this Ruth so worthy. Listen to 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 1 to 7. I'm going to read the whole passage to you. "Likewise, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some of you do not obey, even if some of them do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. When they see your respectful and pure conduct, do not let your adorning be the external adorning, the braiding of your hair, the putting on of gold jewelry, and the clothing that you wear." Do you honestly think that Ruth, who was gleaning because she was so, so poor, could braid her hair and dress beautifully and smell wonderfully and have her nails done at some parlor? How was she adorned? She was adorned in her heart with a beautiful and quiet and gentle spirit. That's what Boaz saw. "But let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which in God's sight is very precious." Very precious. "For this is how the holy woman who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, by submitting to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. And you are to her children if you do good and do not fear anything." Three things that I think Ruth did beautifully. She was a holy woman who hoped in God. She adorned herself in a specific way, which was very different to the way that women of her culture were used to adorning themselves. And she was submissive to her own husband. I think those are three things that were the roots of Ruth's femininity and that made her the incredible wife that she became. Her spirit and her demeanor were completely distinct from the culture that she was part of. And God calls women to be completely distinct. Their spirit, their demeanor, and their value system. To be a worthy woman like Ruth was, we have to grapple with these things. Hoping in God, what does that mean? He gives us Sarah as an example. Sarah, Hebrews 11, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of not things not seen. And he goes on to describe what Sarah did. She didn't look at the deadness of her own body. She wasn't overwhelmed by the desperate need of her situation and the impossibilities that she was faced with. She hoped in God, and she put her faith and her trust in God. And the consequence was God did miracles. And she ended up, the Bible says at the end of that passage, "Do good And do not fear anything that is frightening. The consequence of a woman who has a faith in God, fear nothing that is frightening. And believe me, you and I know well that this world is full of things that we can fear and be frightened of, especially as women. Your raising of children and what's going to become of them, your husband and his work, the stability, the things that frighten women, the things that... Be like Sarah. Hope in God like Sarah did. She was a woman of faith. She hoped in God. She adorned herself in a certain way, imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit. You know, maybe the braiding of your hair and the skin-tight clothing and the nails and the perfume will seduce your husband and get him into the bedroom, but it's not going to bring him to God. And it's not the thing that's of great value and precious to the Lord. The roots of Ruth's femininity were not her external beauty, but her hope in God and her gentle and quiet spirit. Those were the things that made her the woman who was written into the story of God. And then finally, she expressed this hope and this adorning of her inner spirit in a submissiveness to her husband. That word submission has a horrible flavor in today's culture. And it's almost as though headship and submission, people get the feeling that it was the sin of man in the Garden of Eden that invented headship and submission. And in some way, it's God's punishment upon men and women that women should submit and men should lead. Headship and submission was there long before the fall was. The fall perverted headship and submission. Didn't create headship and submission. The fall twisted man's humble, loving headship and made it either into hostile dominion or a lazy indifference. It twisted a woman's intelligent, willing submission into a manipulative obsequiousness or a brazen insubordination. And that's not what God intended in either headship or submission. Headship is not a right to command. Headship is a responsibility to serve in husbands. And submission is not some slavish or coerced cowering. Submission is the willing and glad, intelligent, strong evidence of God's work in your life where you are able to help that husband of yours fulfill the calling that is upon his life. Marriage runs on love and respect. That's Ephesians 5. You know, it's like my car runs on diesel, Irene's car runs on petrol. You can't swap the two. We tend to give what we want to receive. Can you imagine if I went to Irene one Christmas and gave her a present of a 12-bore shotgun? The next Christmas, she'd buy me a very expensive string of pearls. You can't give what you want. Why do you think husbands are told over and over again to love their wives? For the same reason children are told to obey their parents. It's not natural. Children have to be instructed how to obey, and husbands need to be taught how to love. Just the same way wives need to be told to honor and respect. It's not natural. Wives need to be taught to be honoring and respectful towards their husbands, just as children need to be taught to be submissive, to be obedient. Because men run on honor and respect in a marriage, and women run on the sacrificial love of a Christ-like husband. To me, those are some of the roots of Ruth's beautiful femininity and the success of the marriage that they had. What about Boaz, this wonderful Christ-like picture of masculinity? Well, I think there are many things you could say about Boaz, and I just made a list of some of them. He owned a field. He didn't live at home with mommy, who was still doing his washing and ironing. Girls, don't marry a guy whose mommy is still washing his dirty clothes and ironing his underrods. He was an employer. He worked. That's different, eh? He worked. He had a good reputation amongst his men. He was godly. And he became godly before he met Ruth. He was single and sexually pure. He was deeply concerned about Ruth's reputation. He was determined not to procrastinate. He knew and he abided in God's law. These are all wonderful pictures of masculinity, but there are two things I want to pick out about Boaz this morning. Number one is his kindness, and number two is the way he spoke to Ruth. Kindness means to be generously considerate of another. Colossians 3 verse 19, husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. Do not be harsh with them. Boaz was wonderfully kind. Ruth said to him in chapter 2, I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly. Is your wife the object of your kindness, your gentle considerateness? Naomi never left Ruth. Ruth never left Boaz's presence empty-handed. Ruth was safe in his field. He made sure of that. Ruth was fed and watered in his field. He made sure of that. Ruth got more gleaning than anybody else did. He made sure of that. Kindness doesn't go with being a brute or a tyrant or an angry man. Is my wife the beneficiary of my thoughtfulness? Does she benefit from specific deeds from me that leave her feeling safe and cared for and considered and thought about? Lustful husbands are not kind husbands. Wimpish husbands that don't provide leadership are not kind husbands. Husbands who show secret or open contempt for their very able and gifted wives are not kind husbands. Confidence in a man that indicates in some way to his wife, I don't really need you, is not kindness. Men who tear down their wives to make themselves look good and make marriage the butt of their humor are not kind men. Kind husbands are providers, and not just of rands and cents and food on the table, but of time and conversation and emotional input and prayer and spiritual counsel and conversation. Husbands are supposed to be nurturers and nourishers and cherishers, according to Scripture. Nurtured things grow. Nourished things strengthen. Cherished things shine. Our wives ought to be nurtured, nourished, and cherished. They ought to be growing, strengthening, and shining under our words and acts of kindness. A husband's, lastly, a kinsman redeemer. That's what Boaz was. Husbands bring redemption to their homes. Then lastly, how did Boaz... You know, 50% of the book of Ruth is conversation. Because there are lots of women in the story. Not true. But most of this book is conversation. It's words. It's communication. Ephesians 5, listen to this from the message. Husbands, go all out in your love for your wives, exactly as Christ did for the church. A love marked by giving, not by getting. Christ's love makes the church whole. A husband's love makes his wife whole. His words evoke her beauty. Husbands, your words, your spoken words evoke the beauty of your wife. When last did you spend some thoughtful time trying to find words to speak over your wife as Christ has over you and me? Everything he does and says is designed to bring the best out of her. Speaking of Christ's love for you and me and of my love for my wife. Everything I do, designed, thoughtfully, initiated. I mean, you have to, husbands, I can't find words. You have to sit and think about what you're going to say because it's not natural. But you have to find words to wash that woman as Christ found words to evoke your beauty. So your words, what kind of words is your wife blessed by or the victim of in your home? Dressing her in dazzling white silk and radiant with holiness. Do your words dress your wife in dazzling white silk? Do your words put a radiant smile on that woman's face and leave her feeling like the bride of Christ? A word fitly spoken is like an apple of gold in a setting of silver. Gracious words are like honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the body. That's not social media. That's not 160 characters. That's husbands spending thoughtful time in prayer trying to work out how am I going to wash this woman with words that leave her dazzling. What about kids? They had Obed. Why do we have children? To populate the earth? To put more bodies on this planet? We have children to make them disciples of Jesus, worshippers of God. What are the primary objectives of parenting? To raise kids with good manners? To raise kids that behave well? There's nothing wrong with any of those. Believe me, if you have a home group full of kids, you know about that. To raise kids that bring home good report cards? To raise kids that land up with some kind of respectable profession? To raise kids that bring street cred to the family name and culture by who they marry? What are the purposes of marriage and having? What is the purpose of your parenting? I'm telling you, the purpose of your parenting is firstly and primarily to raise followers of Jesus. To raise young men and women who will worship God with all, and everything that we do as parents is filtered through, am I raising a disciple of Jesus? I'm convinced that that's the reason we parent primarily. The story of God, which is what Ruth is, depends deeply on men embracing Christ-like masculinity and women embracing Christ-like femininity, and men behaving as husbands and women as behaving in wives that bring a marriage in a community of believers that ends up being a canvas upon which God paints a picture and tells his story of his love for his bride. Let's stand. I want to read you one last passage from Isaiah. Isaiah 62. Foreign countries will see your righteousness. The band can come. Foreign countries will see your righteousness and world leaders your glory. You'll get a brand new name straight from the mouth of God. You'll be a stunning crown in the palm of God's hand, a jewel gold cup held high in the hand of your God. No more will anyone call you rejected. And your country will no more be called ruined. You'll be called my delight. That's the groom speaking to you and me. You'll be called my delight. And your land married. Because God delights in you. And your land will be like a wedding celebration. For as a young man marries his virgin bride, so your builder marries you. And as a bridegroom is happy in his bride, so your God is happy with you. God bless you.